This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. John Owen says understanding something he calls a tin can explain a lot about political decision-making throughout world history. In this case, tin is not a type of metal, but an acronym for Transnational Ideological Network. As Owen claims in one of his newest books, these networks have had huge impact on governments and nations for hundreds of years. And he says understanding the phenomena can help us better appreciate events in parts of today's world that might otherwise seem, well, beyond understanding. For example, does it strike you as strange that some in the Arab world want their governments controlled by religion? The author of The Clash of Ideas in World Politics has an explanation which may surprise you, but fits right in with his new tin theory of world affairs. And we will get to it right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled The Clash of Ideas in World Politics. Its author, international affairs scholar John Owen, is our guest. 888-WMRA-TALK is our call-in phone number. The so-called Arab Spring, the push to put religion in charge of certain national governments, the when and why fors of regime change, as well as why some nations try to force such change on other governments, are all topics we are likely to get to this hour. So if you have questions on any of those, or a topic of your own to suggest that relates to how nations throughout history have developed the types of governments they have, please do call us at 888-967-2825. John Owen, welcome to the Insight Studios.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Well, John, what is this thing that you have identified in your research that you call a transnational ideological network, and why is it important?
A tin, yes. Let me start with by painting a somewhat broader picture, and then get to the tins in a minute. And I'll start by saying there are different ways to look at what's going on in the Arab world or the Muslim world more broadly. Of course, the Arab world being just a part of the broader Muslim world. And one of those ways, the way I find most fruitful right now, is to say that the Muslim world has for a number of decades been in the throes of an ideological struggle or a legitimacy crisis. That is to say, Muslims disagree very deeply about the right way to organize society, the right institutions and laws under which they should live. And they've done this for since the early 20th century, really. On one side of that divide, very broadly speaking, are secularists who believe that laws and institutions should be generated by human beings through the use of reason or experience. And on the other side, broadly speaking, are what we call Islamists, sometimes pronounced Islamists, who believe in one way or the other that laws and institutions under which Muslims live should derive from the holy texts, the Quran, the Hadith, and so on. And Islamists disagree with each other, sometimes quite violently. There are many varieties of Islamists, but in the first cut we can take it, the problem is that's the main divide between secularists and Islamists. And when we make this move and we say, well, the Muslim world is going through this big, prolonged struggle over the right way to order society, suddenly it can make more sense to us because the West itself in the past has gone through some similar struggles, not between Islamism and secularism, obviously, but between other ideologies. Let's say the one that helped found the United States between monarchism and republicanism, understood not as the GOP, but understood as the idea that rulers should be elected, should not inherit their power. Now, when these struggles exist, they are perpetuated, carried on across a number of countries at once by networks, which I call TINs, transnational ideological networks. Transnational just means they exist in more than one country at once, and they communicate across national boundaries. Now, in the Arab world in particular, the Muslim Brotherhood is the most impressive transnational ideological network. It was founded in Egypt in 1928, opened a number of branches in other Arab countries stretching across North Africa into the Middle East. And Hamas, that runs Gaza and Palestine, is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. There are other transnational ideological networks, much more lethal. Al-Qaeda is an example as well, a much out-and-out terrorist group. But in the past, there have been transnational networks similarly. A colleague of mine has studied ties between Thomas Jefferson and his group, James Madison and so on, in this country, and philosophers in France at the same time, Condorcet and others. Benjamin Franklin was part of this club as well. There were some in England, like Thomas Paine. So that was a similar sort of entity, a transnational network. Very, very different beliefs from the Muslim Brotherhood, to be sure. I'm not saying they believe the same things at all. In fact, they would disagree quite vehemently.
But the whole idea of an ideological network being that there are people who somehow share ideas about what a best government should look like,
yeah,
whether it's a monarchy or a democracy or a socialist republic. Would that be a good example through the 40s, 50s?
That's right. That's right. The Socialist International might be the best known of these, founded by Marx himself in the 19th century, carried on. In fact, it still exists, and it had a number of offshoots like the Communist International in the 20th century. There's still some of these around. There's still some communist. If you can Google this and find, there's still small groups that are still out there fighting what they regard as the good fight. But yeah, and in my book, I go way back into early modern Europe, 500 years ago, and find, lo and behold, there were transnational networks of, say, Calvinists, Presbyterians in Scotland, Puritans in England, in the Netherlands, in Holland, in France, in Germany. And these people, and John Calvin himself kind of got the whole thing going from Geneva, Switzerland. And there was no Facebook, no Al Jazeera, no radio back then. They had the printing press, though, and they communicated very intensely across national borders, encouraged each other, agitated together, and shared a common vision for the right way to order society.
And if I understand correctly, John Owen, what you're saying in this book is that this entity that you have identified for the first time, you write about seeing world affairs and world political history through this lens of what you call the transnational ideological network. That looking at these networks of people with ideas in different parts of the world, sharing those ideas and sharing the push to see those ideas put into action, is a very useful way to see how governments end up coming into being,
yeah,
how governments end up falling in different parts of the world,
right,
how efforts to influence nations by another nation can run into trouble if you don't appreciate this whole concept of a transnational ideological network. And although you don't go into it in great length, it seems to me from reading this new book of yours, The Clash of Ideas in World Politics, that you think that this is a concept that it's really too bad people in the Bush administration didn't understand 10 years ago.
That's right. I won't say the Bush administration were ignorant of the Muslim Brotherhood. They knew, and they certainly knew about Al-Qaeda. That's very clear. But I think one thing they may not have appreciated, let's say going into Iraq, is the degree to which Islamism is a highly robust ideology that had been squashed by Saddam Hussein's regime, and that it would roar back in part because of networks. And I have in mind especially the Shia Islamist networks that run from Iran across Iraq into Hezbollah and Lebanon and other places as well.
And you talk about this very early in this new book. Let me read here, yep, just, I think it's two sentences from page 7. Quote, "One of the most grievous mistakes of the Bush administration was to think that the United States could somehow transcend the Muslims' ideological contest. Americans have found themselves regarded, at least by Islamists, as entrants into that contest, co-belligerents with the secularist enemy. The United States is not ending the struggle, in their view, but helping perpetuate it.
Right.
Is it possible that part of what you're saying here, political scientist John Owen, is that too often in the West, because we don't empathize with the idea that a religion should be in control of governance, which is what, in essence, the Islamists are saying, that we are thinking, well, liberal democracy, which is what we have, is obviously the best system of government. If we help other people in the world, if we take the tyrants and despots out of power and we allow other people to choose their governance, obviously they're going to choose what,
right.
what we have.
Right. And I'm by no means the first to make this critique, but it does seem that the idea took hold among some in the Bush administration that everyone out there would like to live as Americans live if only given the opportunity. And if you lift the oppressive hand of the Ba'athist state in Iraq or the Taliban in Afghanistan, everyone's inner American will come out and be able to flourish. And I want to be clear. I like our free market democracy. I wouldn't want to live in under a different system. But for whatever reason, for a variety of reasons, we have to be careful not to universalize that and just assume everyone secretly wants to be us. If only given the chance, they would grab it.
The book is titled The Clash of Ideas in World Politics: Transnational Networks, States, and Regime Change from 1510 to 2010. Its author, international political affairs researcher John Owen, is our guest. If you have a question or comment for him, our phone lines are now open at 888-WMRA-TALK, 1-888-967-2825. Do you have an idea, listening, about what you think the best system of governance in the world is? Do you have an idea on how you feel people in one part of the world make mistakes in judging other parts of the world's systems of governance? We'd be happy to hear your thoughts as well as your questions at 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Explain a little bit more, if you would, John Owen, about what Islamism is and what it isn't. One of the things that I admit I didn't know, early in your book, you point out that the word Islam translates in English to submission.
Right.
Submission to God.
Right. Yeah. Islamism is a broad category. It's useful in some ways. Journalists use it a lot. Politicians, scholars use it. But it's an oversimplification, like all broad terms. But it is the basic stance that the laws and institutions of society should be drawn from the Quran and the Hadith, or the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. You hear the word Sharia frequently. That's Islamic law. So Islamists basically believe that Sharia should govern society. And
Is there agreement among Islamists on what that would look like?
No, not at all. And I'm glad you asked that, because that's a really important point to make. There are many divisions among Islamists. The most evident is between the two great branches of Islam, Shia and Sunni. And the Sunni are a majority of the world's Muslims. Sunni Islam is prominent in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, North Africa. Shia Islam is prominent in Iran, and it's the majority religion, majority branch in Iraq, and has a following in lots of other countries as well. Right off the bat, those two groups of Islamists disagree quite sharply about what Sharia looks like, who's supposed to say what it is, how it's enforced. And then within, let's say, Sunni Islamism, you have lots of disagreement as well about whether a democracy can be an Islamist state, or whether you need an authoritarian or a monarchical state to have an Islamist state.
It seems to me that although they may interpret the term differently, running through all of these different groups who want religion in charge of governance is a question of morality, what we could do to have a more moral society, as opposed to what they see as decadence in other parts of the world. I want to ask you more about that, John Owen, and how that may relate to some religious differences here in this country when we continue on Virginia Insight. Our guest, John Owen, once actually thought of becoming a lawyer, but put that on hold while he worked for a year as a newspaper reporter in High Point, North Carolina, covering local government. Something about that experience must have convinced him that his real interest was figuring out how national governments have worked around the world throughout history. After graduate studies at Princeton and Harvard, he taught for a time at Harvard, Stanford, and Bowdoin before arriving at the University of Virginia, where today he serves as a professor of international relations. His new book, The Clash of Ideas in World Politics, and his new theory contained in that book that he calls transnational ideological networks is at the heart of our discussion today. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So tell me, if you would, John, about this view of morality in different places in the world, particularly in those places where there's currently this dispute over whether or not religion should be in charge of public life.
Right. You know, I sometimes am asked, isn't the Islamist movement or set of movements basically the same thing as, let's say, the Christian right in the United States? Aren't they, don't they have the same goals? Are they different religions? But isn't it a similar social movement? And I think there is an analogy, and there is some good scholarship on the so-called global religious revival over the past 30 years. Across cultures, we have seen, contrary to what Thomas Jefferson believed many, many years ago, that religion would die away. Actually, it's on the rebound in most parts of the world. And so there's some similarities, but there are some crucial differences as well we might want to talk about. But one similarity is a critique between, say, religious conservatives in this country and Islamists, a critique of what they regard as decadence, the decadence of modern society, seen in particular in the breakdown of the family. Islamists complain, one of their chief complaints about the West is that we are pushing our lifestyle, our way of life on them, and they don't want it. It's not just Christianity, it's secularism that they don't want. And they associate secularism with things like a high divorce rate, high rates of illegitimacy, not taking care of your parents when they get older, and so on. And these are some that many Americans would lodge the same complaints about their own society. The families are weaker, people are more individualistic, and so on. But all that is to say that you're right. One of the chief motives behind Islamism is a complaint about decadence and a complaint about what they think of as cultural imperialism, that we in the West are forcing this on them. And looked at that way, given that a lot of Americans have a similar complaint, it doesn't look quite as crazy.
You actually go through 500 years of history in this book, looking at international political affairs through this new lens that you've created, these ideological networks that cross nations, people with similar ideas in different parts of the world joining together to try and get government change in one place in the world.
Right.
Is there something that's happened in Western history that, in your view, John Owen, is in any way analogous to what's going on now in the Arab world and this battle between the secularists and the religionists?
Oh, yes. There are at least three prolonged cases that stretch many decades that I think are similar. Not identical, but similar. And I guess, let me pick out the middle one somewhat arbitrarily. I mentioned a minute ago, this country was born at the outset of one of these long ideological struggles in the West, and that was between monarchism, the idea that society should be ruled by a king and that aristocrats should have inherited privileges, and on the one hand. The other hand, the other side was republicanism, the notion that we should be governed by people we elect who didn't inherit their title. This struggle was born in Europe and the United States in roughly the 1760s, 1770s. The American Revolution was the first igniting of it. It really caught fire with the French Revolution that started in 1789. And what happened there was the French Revolution activated this transnational network of republicans, again, people who believe that government should be elected, not inherited, networks spanning from France into Central Europe, into the British Isles, across the Atlantic to North and South America, saying that the global revolution is here. This is an exciting time to live. Monarchs are going to topple everywhere, and freedom and justice will reign everywhere. And in fact, there were waves of revolution over the next several decades. You also saw these transnational networks constantly at work through the following decades. You saw also foreign interventions as well. Governments seeing a revolution in another country or a revolution about to happen, deciding they wanted to help it or to hinder it, and sending troops in to help or hinder the revolution. So in all of those ways, what happened in the late 1700s, early 1800s in Europe and the Americas is a lot like what's been going on in the Muslim world in more recent decades.
University of Virginia Professor of International Relations John Owen is our guest. His book is titled The Clash of Ideas in World Politics. If you have an idea you'd care to share with us about world politics or a question to ask, you can call us at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. We are getting some posts on Facebook, but let me say once again, that means that you get to hear too much of my voice reading other people's questions and comments. So if you're willing to share your voice just to help us break things up and make it more interesting, please do call us at 888-967-2825. We have this comment from Donald, who says, in answer to a question actually that we put up early this morning on our Facebook page, John, where we asked, do you understand why... That was a different question. I'm looking at the wrong place. Basically is, do you ever wonder why it is that some people seem to favor the idea of religion being in charge of their government? And in response to that question, Donald says, well, the same sentiment exists in America on the right, seeing that many Arab nations are far to the right politically and culturally, and given the far-right nature of patriarchal Islam, this should be no surprise.
Mm-hmm. Well, it gets back to something I said a moment ago about the, again, I want to be very careful to say the Christian right in the United States is not the same thing as the Islamist movement. There's some significant differences, but there's a similar set of complaints, a similar idea that traditional society has some, we can learn some things from traditional society, from the older ways. And so on. And I do think that helps us, once we see the similarity, helps us understand a bit about where the Islamists are coming from, without endorsing their position or saying that they do have the right solutions for Muslims. I think that's something for Muslims to decide for themselves. But it does make what they're trying to do a bit more intelligible, perhaps.
Well, when Don says that most Arab nations are far to the right of the U.S. politically and culturally, and the nature of patriarchal Islam, those sound to me like the type of things we sometimes hear from people about what Islam is all about that some political scientists take issue with. Would you take issue with Don's characterization of Islam, or would you largely agree?
I would say Islam is a very diverse religion. That's one thing we need to keep in mind. I'll say I do want to stress that there are Muslims, and I know many, who regard themselves as secularists. I've just been talking about Islamism, but I said at the outset that there's a struggle going on within the Islamic world between secularists and Islamists of various types. Secularism was predominant among Muslim elites from the early 20th century, really through the late 1960s. So 50 years ago, it would have been a great shock for most Arab elites to if they had a crystal ball and could see what was going on now, they would be shocked that Islamists are as powerful as they are. But there are secularists who remain. Many of them live in the West. Many of them live in the Arab world and elsewhere. And by secularists, again, I mean they are Muslims. They regard themselves as practicing Muslims, but they don't believe that the laws in their society should primarily derive from religious sources. They believe that the laws can derive from secular sources, and they can still live as good Muslims under those laws. So,
is there any analogy to that in the West with somebody who considers themselves a devout Christian, mm-hmm. but does not necessarily believe that that means that governments should institute certain tenets of Christian faith, even tenets that not all Christians agree upon, into the rule of law?
Right.
That not yep. you can be a good Christian and not automatically think that you have to have laws that discriminate against anybody who's a homosexual.
Right.
Or that you have to have laws that prevent any kind of abortion. And I don't mean to any way trivialize this, but it seems to me that 50 years ago, there was a fair amount of debate of whether if you were a good Christian, would you be in favor of laws that kept people from doing any shopping on Sundays?
Right, right. I think that's a good way to think about it. In the United States today and other Western countries, Christians disagree on the details quite a bit, pro-life versus pro-choice, and so on. But most agree you can be a Christian without saying we should draw our society's laws directly from the Bible, which that's analogous to the strong Islamist claim. The Islamists say we should draw our laws from the Quran and the Hadith. It's hard to find a Christian living in a Western country who says we should draw our laws from Old Testament law. I think there are small movements that say that, but they are very small and marginal and have very little influence. Most Christians believe that I don't know if I can make this general statement. Many Christians believe that the law should be shaped in some way by Christian tradition. So closing stores on Sunday would be an example of that, or laws limiting or prohibiting abortion would be another way of saying that. But that's a different position than saying we already have the law, it's in the scripture, and we just need to apply it and execute it. That's the strong Islamist claim. And this, I'm glad you asked this, because people who puzzle out where Islamism might go from here often say something like the following. Europe and Latin America have what are called Christian democratic parties. We don't have such parties in the English-speaking world. They sound a little funny to our ears. But Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, and lots of Latin American countries have parties that are historically, they draw their roots from Christian teaching, but they are not theocratic parties by any means. They are very democratic, liberal parties in that sense. But they do have this sense that the laws of society should be derived from a tradition of a broadly Christian tradition. Now, the party that governs Turkey, a Muslim country, says the same thing about Islam. They say, we're not theocrats. This is the ruling party in Turkey. We're not theocrats, but we are conservative Democrats. We believe that a Muslim society like Turkey should have laws that are shaped by the tradition of our society. And for them, that means a Muslim tradition.
The book is titled The Clash of Ideas in World Politics. Its author, John Owen, is our guest. If you want to talk to him, we've got a couple of phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Andrea in Louisa, thanks for using that number and calling in your question or comment, please.
Hi. Having done a thesis my own many years ago about transnational systems, I'm curious how the current last 500 years could be compared to more ancient transnational systems such as the Greek or Roman empires or the Han Chinese taking over basically all of the rest of China.
Yeah, it's a I'm glad you asked that. I'll talk to one case. I'll speak of one case of that. If you look at ancient Greece, roughly 500 BC, this is the period that the historian Thucydides wrote about. I've actually assigned this in one of my classes for next week. This is the famous war between Athens and Sparta. It was the sort of the Cold War of its time. In fact, during our Cold War, the Soviet Union, the Soviet-American contest was often compared to the ancient contest between Athens and Sparta. Now, Athens was a democracy, and Sparta was an oligarchy, meaning it was ruled by a very small number of men who owned lots of property and had lots of money. And these two fought a war that took many, many years to resolve. They fought it in a lot of different city-states in ancient Greece. And some of these city-states were democracies, and some were oligarchies. And one thing Athens tried to do was promote democracy in other cities because it had networks of democrats stretching across ancient Greece. And Sparta had networks of oligarchs stretching across ancient Greece. And the oligarchs in a given city tended to sympathize with Sparta, and the democrats in a given city tended to sympathize with Athens. And so this is an ancient version of what I'm talking about, these networks. I'm afraid I don't know enough about the Han Chinese to comment on that, but it wouldn't surprise me to find similar dynamics going on there as well.
Andrea, does that address your question?
Yes, it does. Thank
it was a terrific question. Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing it.
Thank you.
888-WMRA-TALK, 1-888-967-2825. If you want to join us here on Virginia Insight with political scientist John Owen, author of the new book, The Clash of Ideas in World Politics, and the new lens through which he suggests we see political developments across the world and throughout history, tell us again what it's called. Transnational. See, I was about to cough and have to clear my throat, so I was just hoping I could get you to tell us what a tin is.
Here it goes, because it takes a while to get it out. Transnational Ideological Networks. And I'm glad, Tom, you've given me a name for the theory at last, the tin theory. I've struggled to come up with a name for it.
In your book, you talk a little bit about what the current struggle is in some places in the world where we've come to think of what's been happening as the Arab Spring. Mm. And the dispute over whether the result in some places in the world where these revolutions, I guess you would call them, are going on, is going to result in religion-controlled governments or something more like the liberal democracy that we in the West seem to think of as the best type of government. Tell us a little bit about how this, I'm trying to think of the world, and we're going to run out of time before the break, John. I can't think of the word. There's been this battle going on much longer than most of us realize.
Right.
So tell us about that history, if you would.
Yeah. In the early 20th century, the Ottoman Empire, which is the sort of ancestor of modern Turkey, ran the Middle East.
Let me set it up a little bit better now that we hear the music and we know the break is coming up. For much of the time that Islam existed in the world, people in nations where Islam was the dominant religion lived in a nation where that religion was in charge of the government.
Right.
And it's really only in fairly recent history that that's changed.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to ask you to do is to take us back to that recent history and show us the thread, there's the word I was looking for,
there you go,
for how that relates to what's going on today. John Owen has authored or edited a number of books on international affairs, including one titled Liberal Peace, Liberal War, and another, Religion, the Enlightenment, and the New Global World Order. But the book at the center of today's conversation was published just over 1 year ago by Princeton University Press, and it is titled The Clash of Ideas in World Politics. So take us through this thread that starts pretty much after a change in government in the Islamic world took place.
Right. Traditional Islam understood the best kind of government as a universal empire run by the successor to the Prophet Muhammad. And the Ottoman Empire was that for several centuries. The Ottoman Empire, run out of Turkey, fell after World War I, and in its place was established the Republic of Turkey, which was a secular, in fact, aggressively secular republic. Ataturk, the founder, basically had the state take over the mosques and decide what true Islam was, ran the seminaries. So he didn't try to eradicate Islam. He wasn't so foolish as to try that, but he tried to transform it quite radically and made Turkish politics secular. That is, it was no longer going to be run by a successor to the Prophet Muhammad. It was going to be run by him. Ataturk had imitators in other Muslim countries. The Shahs of Iran admired him greatly. Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, admired him. Later in Egypt, Nasser was an admirer. And Nasser started his own secularist movement in the Arab world in the 1950s that really caught on in the 50s and 60s. It put quite a scare into the Saudis. Saudi Arabia is a very strictly Islamist country. And also, there was an Islamist revival over in Iran that pitted the Ayatollah Khomeini, the young Khomeini, against the Shah of Iran. And so the contest was well underway by the middle of the 20th century between the secularists and the Islamists. And the Islamists started to push back against Ataturk and the secularists because they were really concerned that you could not live as a pious Muslim under a secular government, that to be a true Muslim, obedient to God, you had to live under Islamic law. And so that was the early basis of the disagreement.
Now, do you think it's reasonable that some of the reaction was what it was among pious Muslims in places like Egypt, where they felt what they saw was abuse of power, corruption, some people getting rich, the poor continuing to starve and be getting in worse and worse conditions? And although I guess we don't often think about it in this country, part of what Islam preaches as a form of governance is care for everyone, doesn't it?
That's right. Now, some of these secularists claim to be egalitarian as well. In fact, Nasser was a socialist, an Arab socialist, so he was concerned with the condition of the poor. But the Egyptian state he set up has not really helped the poor as much as planned. I want to say something else about secularism in these countries. It's not the same thing as the secularism that we have in the United States. It's much more hard-nosed, hard-edged, much more coercive. I said a minute ago that Ataturk had the state take over the mosques. This is something we don't do in the United States. It's something the Soviets did, but in the Western world, we don't do it. So when I say secularism, historically, it has actually been a much more coercive type system than we have. And I think that helps explain the militance of many Islamists. They're pushing back not against a mild secular state that doesn't coerce, that just separates church and state. They're pushing back against a state that really took over the religion and presumed to say, here's what Islam is and here's what it is not.
We have another comment that gets back to something we were discussing before, but on our Facebook page, but it might be worth touching back on that again. Again, this was in response to the question that we'd put up early this morning. Does it strike you as at all strange that some in the Arab world want their governments controlled by religion? And here we have from Bruno, quote, "Not really, but I'm more concerned about the way things have moved here in recent years. One of the founding principles of this nation was the freedom to worship who, when, and where a person wants, and just as importantly, to not worship. And so when President Obama said, 'Make no mistake, we are a Christian nation,' I thought, really? Because I was taught that we are a nation of people, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Wiccan, Muslim, etc., but free to choose." Bruno, just let me point out that I'm pretty sure you've misquoted President Obama there, because I tried to look up that quote when I saw it, and the only thing that I've seen is there have been several times when President Obama has said, "We are not just a Christian nation." But to his point that in our society in America, there is an ethic that says we ought to be free to choose.
Right.
You have a response to that?
Yeah, and it started here in Virginia, we like to say, with this statute on religious freedom that Thomas Jefferson authored, one of the achievements he was most proud of. Yeah, and let me take this back to the Arab Spring and the Arab world and what's going on now, because and get back to this idea that there are different types of Islamists. I'll say, first of all, it's clear that in Egypt and elsewhere, a majority of citizens are some kind of Islamist, or at least they support the Islamists. The Egyptian elections have returned about 2/3 of the seats in the lower house of parliament to Islamists. This is a real shock to Western analysts that we were not expecting this, but it's just a fact. Now, that sounds frightening on its surface. We want to dig a little bit more deeply, though. Islamists don't all agree.
Tell me why it sounds frightening.
It sounds
Why are so many of us in America and the West scared of religion being in control of a government if that religion is Islam?
I think it's because we associate it with either of two things or both of two things: Iran and the Ayatollah Khomeini and the black turban and the beard and the stern visage and hostage taking, or Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and 9/11, a much worse phenomenon. And those are Islamists. You cannot say, oh, that's just two people. Those are major movements that have proven robust over time. But Islamism is much larger than those two movements, those two men. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is showing itself to be a more moderate entity than we had thought. The Egyptian Islamists are divided among two major parties now, the Salafist Party, which is much stricter and apparently receiving funding from Saudi Arabia, and the Muslim Brotherhood, which is much older and appears to be moderating, appears to want to live, be in a coalition government, perhaps with some secularists, doesn't appear to be aiming at coercing Egyptians to embrace a strict form of Islamic law. Now, I keep saying appear, we don't know. We really don't know. I cannot sit here and say, don't worry about the Muslim Brotherhood. They're just like you and me. They want the same things. We really don't know. But they are clearly more moderate than some Islamists. So when we think Islamism, we need to start broadening our view. I mentioned Turkey a moment ago. Turkey has been governed for going on a decade now by an Islamist party, but a very moderate, mild one, the Justice and Development Party. And that party has transnational networks. It has a lot of influence over Arab Islamists in Egypt and elsewhere. And it could be that what we're looking at in the Arab Spring is the emergence of something like a more moderate Islamism, such as we're seeing in Turkey. Now, that's good news in that it means we're not looking at a Taliban or an Iranian-type Islamism. The bad news is that Islamists, even the Muslim Brotherhood and the moderates who govern Turkey, don't see eye to eye with the United States and the West on some crucial issues. They don't agree with our Israel policy. That's quite clear. They are more skeptical in general toward American foreign policy in the Middle East. The close relations we've had with Saudi Arabia to keep world oil prices stabilized, very skeptical of that. So even a moderate Islam governing countries like Egypt will give us some problems. We'll have to adjust, maybe cut some new deals with them. That's the bad news. The good news, again, is that we may not be looking at a militant, violent, imperialistic Islamism, but we may be looking at something much more moderate.
It seems to me that I've noted a couple of times in this book, John Owen, The Clash of Ideas in World Politics, where you talk about at least through history, there being nations that were controlled by an Islamic religious regime, but they were very tolerant of other religions, of Christianity, of Judaism.
Right. Yeah. This we know about, especially the Ottoman Empire that I mentioned a moment ago. It was around for more than 500 years.
But that's certainly not what happening in a place like Iran.
Yeah, today. Yeah.
And I wonder if what happened in Iran is evidence of what I think one of the things that you're saying in your book is you kind of got to be careful what you wish for, especially if you don't investigate the history involved, because in the mid to late 70s, there were many people with liberal democratic ideals in different places in the world that thought getting rid of the Shah of Iran and letting the Ayatollah come in would be a good thing,
right.
Would mean an end to corruption and more power to the people.
Yeah.
And we ended up with something quite different in Iran.
Yeah. And this gets back to your question a moment ago. Why fear an Islamist outcome to the Arab Spring? Well, Iran is exhibit A. You know, the Shah was an oppressive dictator, no question about it. The Iranian people had a lot to complain about, a lot to revolt against, and they did. However, what they got as a replacement is, on, I think, most reasonable measures, at least as bad and probably worse. And you saw the violent face of that regime, if you'll remember, back in May and June of 2009 when Iran had elections and the results were negated by the state. And you had basically something like a military takeover of Iran. It is a brutal regime, no question about it. But again, not all Islamism needs to end up the way Iran has. We do have other models. If I could, I'll take this in a slightly different direction. We all want to know how the Arab Spring is going to turn out, and more generally, what's happening to the Muslim world, and how will it affect the West and American interests. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that, of course, we can't know for sure, but one way to a good predictor of how an ideological struggle is going to come out is to look at what I call exemplary states, countries that have a lot of power and influence that exemplify or are an example of one of the ideologies. So, for example, in the Cold War between communism and democratic capitalism, the United States was the exemplar of democracy. The Soviet Union was the main exemplar of communism. And when the United States in the 1980s outperformed the Soviet Union, obviously, it meant democratic capitalism won as a system. There are very few communists, true communists, in the world anymore. It's part because the United States so obviously outperformed the Soviet Union. Well, thinking about the Muslim world, what are the exemplary states? I think it's reasonable to say the main exemplar of Islamism is Iran. And the main exemplar of secularism has probably been Egypt, and that obviously it's not going so well. But let me talk about Iran and how Iran has done and the importance of Iran's example. Up until about a year ago, Iran was really on a roll. It was a very impressive fourth leading oil producer, strategic location on the Persian Gulf, for decades able to defy the United States and to defy Israel, lots of transnational networks. It was developing a nuclear program, and I think the smart money would say nuclear weapons. We don't know that, but it's pretty clear that Iran's on its way to becoming a nuclear power. And it had a great following among the average, let's say, Arab. Iran's not an Arab country. It's Persian, but Arabs were paying close attention to Iran. And part of Islamism's appeal derived from Iran's impressive performance as a country. It really was. I mean, Americans don't like dealing with Iran, but frankly, it's managed to do some impressive things. Then the Arab Spring happened, and Iran found itself on the wrong side of history, it looks like. Iran started to back the oppressive Syrian regime against its own Sunni minority. And Arabs all over the Arab world noticed this, and there's been opinion polls of this. Arab opinion of Iran has plummeted over the last 12 months. So it's not so clear that Iran is performing so well anymore in the eyes of Arabs. And that's good news for those of us who think Iran's more virulent, militant brand of Islamism is not a good thing for Arabs. Meanwhile, Turkey has done really well, and Turkey is an example of a much more moderate Islamism.
We're going to run out of time here in just a moment, and I ought to mention that there's someone named George in Farmville who's put a couple of long posts on our Facebook page. Don't have time to go into it at length, but it looks like he's written some books about Christianity and come up with a theory that, in essence, since biblical times, every 509 years, he seems to be saying, something really tremendous happens in world history. We don't have time to get into his theory there, but in terms of the 500 years, the past 500 years that you've looked at, am I correct in what I was gauging in reading your book, that one of the things that you seem to be saying is, after lots of turmoil and experimenting with different forms of government, what we seem to keep coming back to is moderation?
Eventually, these big contests slow down and stop. And they stop, I argue, when one exemplary state just clearly outperforms another, such as, again, when the United States just clearly outperformed the Soviet Union. And that's happened throughout history. And, yeah, these contests peter out and moderation takes over. That doesn't mean that liberal democracy always wins. It may not win. It didn't win in the past. It's won more recently. It may not win in the future. But it does mean that things calm down and people work out a way to live together.
And if you are going to intervene in another country's affairs, you think, John Owen, that you ought to take a deep look at the transnational ideological networks that are affecting that country.
That's right. Figure out who they are, what they want, and if they want to work with you or not.
Our guest has been University of Virginia Professor of Politics and International Relations, as well as author of The Clash of Ideas in World Politics, John Owen. John, thanks so much for your time.
My great pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.